And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
This morning, in Rocky Mountain National Park, a male elk bugled out from the mountain ledge that he was looking for a mate. In New York City, a gray squirrel quickly cached an oak seed for later retrieval. And in the Atlantic Ocean, a giant leatherback sea turtle continued her move eastward, one which began 1,800 miles earlier from the coast of South America after laying her eggs on a soft sand shore. And along the Gulf Coast, vast stretches lie in ruin from Hurricane Katrina. Life indeed goes on in its many manifest ways. When I return with your voice of the earth here on the Wildside News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Hello, and welcome to you from the sunny shores of the Pacific Ocean. There are few real words to describe anymore the real story of Katrina. There is no single story of survival or suffering, ocean surge or strength, that will do justice to the scale of destruction that we are witnessing. For those who must live with it now as we speak, we offer our hope-filled thoughts and prayers. The recovery will test the strength of our nation and challenge the American spirit in ways we in this generation have never before faced. There is plenty of justifiable talk about the failures associated with the storm. It is not finger-pointing or blaming for those of us who sat watching the story emerge 2 weeks ago this Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, who jumped from our couches and yelled out for help and wondered why there was no obvious sense of urgency from our federal government. We in America have prided ourselves with our ability to respond to crisis, but it seems that of late, the perceived common sense of the American people has been regularly ignored, spurned, and ridiculed by a new form of Americanism hell-bent on forging a new dream for the world. Damn the consequences. Well, the consequences of such arrogance are now being revealed as the floodwaters are pumped from what was New Orleans, as hundreds of thousands fled for their lives, and as hundreds of thousands could not. There comes a time in almost every ill-conceived master plan when the water hits the wall, and it did. And no matter how hard some will try, the facts remain. And it is now an epical moment in the history of not only the world, but more personally, America. Today, we keep moving forward, as we must, as we continue to bring you the saga of the American environmental movement. After all, the warnings and concerns of environmental consequences have been the battle cry of the activists who pressure, through various means, the forces of power to wake up and realize that you don't mess with Mother Nature for too long. This past weekend in San Francisco, the granddaddy of all environmental organizations, the Sierra Club, had an historic conference which brought over 4,000 of its members into a hall to rechart their course as the changing social, political, economic, and environmental realities demand new thinking and action to meet the emerging challenge. In parts 2 and 3, we talk with Greg Cassini, a board member of the Sierra Club, who was instrumental in bringing this conference to consensus about how the environmental community is learning to communicate from community to nation to world. And following the news, we talk with Brant Olson with the Rainforest Action Network about their continuing work to preserve the Grand Forest through concerted, conscientious action on the ground and in the boardrooms of those with power and the resources which affect the face of our forests and our future. It's a show of today and of tomorrow. So first, the news. In the wake of Hurricane Katrina lies the nation's largest total damage figure. Quickly jumping from first estimates of $40 billion, the best estimate as of today is $125 billion, with some estimates saying $160 billion or more. The insurance industry is already digging deep to come up with the estimated $60 billion in damage compensation that they will have to coffer up to rebuild the devastated Gulf states. In New Orleans, estimates of $10 billion just for road repairs gives a sense of the caliber of the storm's economic and social impact. As yet, the true scope of damage to the natural environment has not been determined. Louisiana's Secretary for the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries estimated that there would be massive destruction of the habitat in the coastal area, rich in wildlife and fisheries. Particularly hard hit will be the shrimp and oyster industries, as the storm knocked out so much of the infrastructure supporting these markets. As well, the recreation industry will take a long time to recover as boats, docks, and supporting businesses assess the capacity to attract their normal clients. As Lake Pontchartrain takes the fusty waters from the flooded city of New Orleans, concerns about what will happen to downriver areas of the Gulf are unknown. Any filter feeders, such as oysters, process these contaminants into their systems. Close monitoring will be in order. Of course, in every tragedy, there comes the potential for something good. And that is what is getting certain legislators a bit gleeful. Last week, Congressman Joe Barton of Texas and Chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee described the possibility that the hurricane might increase public support for expanded drilling as a, quote, silver lining, and called for lifting offshore drilling restrictions and for drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Other congressional leaders are exploiting the Katrina aftermath in an effort to rush through opening of protected areas to oil and gas drilling. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, Resources Committee Chairman Richard Combo, and Senator Pete Domenici, who recently helped push through the National Energy Bill as chairman of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, announced his intent to open protected offshore areas by saying, "I'm going to go after OCS, the Outer Continental Shelf." David Jenkins, Government Affairs Director for REP, Republicans for Environmental Protection, offered a different perspective on the Katrina aftermath. "At a time when our party should be providing forward-thinking leadership on energy, it is truly unfortunate that some choose instead to exploit current events and perpetuate Americans' dangerous dependence on oil," Jenkins said. "It is time for our Republican leaders to step up and act in the long-term interest of the American people rather than the short-time interests of the oil and gas industry." And while we drown in the swirl of the spinmeisters, let's go ahead and give you the latest from the World Health Organization. Margaret Chan, responsible for helping defend the world against an influenza pandemic that could kill millions, says an outbreak of bird flu among humans may be imminent. The good news is that it may not be too late, or more precisely, it may not be too late to delay the spread of the pandemic, which is predicted to put 25 million people into the hospitals and cause 7 million deaths globally within a short period. In comparison, the current death toll from Katrina stands at just under 1,000, with thousands more expected as the final search continues. And while the aftermath of Katrina mysteriously pushes the price of oil down, at least temporarily, the longer-term pricing may not be as kind. The worldwide oil crisis that is looming is seeing a grab by nations for existing stocks and reserves, and some nations and businesses are deciding to cash in on the new opportunity. China recently bought up the Encana company with oil reserves in Ecuador, South America's second-largest source of American oil imports, as it quietly buys up global production. The new oil firm, Andean, will be wholly owned by CNPC, the Chinese petroleum giant. And finally, for anyone wanting something solid to hitch your sails to, 11 endangered leatherback turtles have donned satellite transmitters, then released from various spots on the shores of the Atlantic Ocean to see what they do. The leatherback turtles are the world's largest turtles, whose shells can reach as much as 5 feet in diameter. In a little over 2.5 months, Echidna, the sea turtle, has covered over 1,800 open ocean miles and dived to nearly 2,000 feet. Each of the turtles travels are being tracked and displayed on a special web page provided by the parent sponsor, the World Wildlife Fund, WWF, and can be viewed at www.panda.org. Amongst all of the chaos, confusion, and catastrophe that fills our news these days, it is good to know that in many respects, the wild wonders continue in their personal sagas of survival. May we all learn to listen, learn, and take action to keep the wonder alive. And that's the news. The Wild Side News continues to bring you the stories you will not hear anywhere else. Tell your friends. Spread the news. And now we turn our attentions to this call to action from the Rainforest Action Network. With all the talk about Katrina in the news these days, which certainly is justified because it is a monumental natural disaster, as well as economic and social crisis for America right now. Nevertheless, although it is a huge story, it is not the only story, and there are groups still working all over the country here to make a difference, and around the world. And one of those groups is the Rainforest Action Network, which is very busy continuing its work on campaigns that it's already started. And joining us now is Brant Olson with the Rainforest Action Network, which you can visit at ran.org. Brant, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
First of all, for people who haven't heard about the Rainforest Action Network, why don't you give us a summary of what your mission and vision is?
Sure. Rainforest Action Network has been around for about 20 years. In fact, this year we're celebrating our 20th anniversary. And for all of those 20 years, we've been working to protect the world's endangered forests, including the rainforest, certainly, but more than that. Forests globally are certainly under severe threat from industrial forestry. So we've been working for the last couple of decades to protect those forests and the rights of their inhabitants. And we've done that mainly through engaging the marketplace directly. So while others may fight legal battles or do lobbying on Capitol Hill, we prefer to go directly to the corporations that are responsible for environmental destruction.
And that actually brings us to the topic of today's discussion, and that is some work that you're focusing on in Oregon and Washington. Why don't you give us a background on that?
Sure. Well, for several years, Rainforest Action Network and a network of allies really all over the country and at one point all over the world had been focusing in on a company called Boise Cascade. And Boise Cascade at that time had been doing logging of old growth forests in the United States, just particularly in the Pacific Northwest, as well as importing a number of products from overseas that were having a hugely detrimental impact on rainforest ecosystems abroad. And so after several years of campaigning in 2003, the company actually adopted a policy to stay out of old growth forests. And a number of other measures, including screening all of their international purchasing from illegal logging. And that was a real achievement. They were the first company, first American company, to make a commitment to stay out of old growth areas. And we were real pleased at that development. Well, in the intervening years since 2003, the company has gone through a lot of changes. The management and the executive team at the top has changed over. They spun off a couple of their divisions so that the forest lands themselves are actually privately owned now by another entity, and their paper distribution division has now been wrapped into OfficeMax. So it's a very different company. But the policy that they adopted in 2003, we believe, should still apply. And so we were very concerned when we saw that they had removed this landmark agreement from the company's website and simultaneously moved into two old-growth areas of national forests in Oregon and Washington. And so you can imagine, you know, all of the folks that worked real hard leading up to 2003 in that agreement with Boise were pretty concerned. And so what we've done is kind of gone back out to that network of supporters, particularly those local folks in Oregon and Washington concerned with these national forests, and launched a campaign to remind the company that they have a commitment. So we've been tying green ribbons on trees in these areas that are scheduled to be logged. And we've also gone back to Boise, Idaho, where the company is headquartered, hanging green ribbons all around town to remind the community and to remind Boise themselves that they have a commitment to uphold. And we feel that, you know, if Boise really is a tr- trustworthy company, then they'll keep that agreement that they made with us and really with all of Americans back in 2003.
I really think the idea of green ribbons is a sensationally powerful, positive pressure point to place on the company. For people in the area, how can you help us understand where these specific locations are in Washington and in Oregon? Where would people find these on a map?
Well, in Washington, it's an area in the Wenatchee National Forest. So that's just south of Wenatchee, east on the east side of the Cascades, if you know where that is.
Mm-hmm.
So, Seattle, it's going to be about five or six hours east of Seattle on the other side of the Cascade Mountain Range.
Mm-hmm.
And in the specific area there, it's called the Eagle Late Successional area. And so the Late Successional designation actually is a designation by the Forest Service that's actually trying to regrow old growth characteristics. So clearly this is old growth in an area that Boise should stay out of. In Oregon, we're talking about an area that's in the Deschutes National Forest. Again, this is on the east side, the east side of the state, on the east side of the range there. So it's not the coastal forests that a lot of folks, I think, would, that go up the I-5 corridor would recognize. But it's on the east side of the mountain, and it's certainly critical habitat.
In terms of the green ribbons themselves, I mean, are you supplying these? Do you encourage people to get their own green ribbon? How's that happening?
Really is a grassroots effort, and it's actually an idea that grew out of the town of Leavenworth, which is real close to where the logging is scheduled to happen in Washington. And so that really just kind of grew organically out of that area. And then we have, the ability to contact a much broader list of folks. You know, we have supporters, more than 30,000 supporters nationwide. And so we put out the call, to our network to say, tie a green ribbon in your community to show some solidarity with folks that care about protecting old growth forests.
So in reality, although it started in that area, this is becoming a national campaign throughout the United States to protect our American old growth forests.
Absolutely. We don't have much left. There's only about 4% of America's original old growth forests that still remain. Most folks want to make sure that those areas are preserved. And so especially for the areas that aren't protected as parks, folks care about these areas. Most people are shocked to learn that national forests, particularly old growth areas of our national forests, are available to be commercially logged. So in this case, particularly when you have a company who's made a promise to stay out of these areas, it's important to raise a fuss when these areas come under threat. So hopefully we'll be able to raise the profile of this issue. We'll be able to put a little heat under the feet of Boise Cascade and keep these areas protected.
I know that RAND very often does a face-to-face with the major players in companies. Have you had a chance to do that in this particular situation? And if so, what has been their justification for this change?
We have. Soon after we learned about this issue, we put a call in to the CEO of Boise Cascade, Tom Stevens, and he actually flew out to our offices in San Francisco. We had we met for the better part of the morning, kind of outlining our concerns, and we were encouraged that the company came to listen. I think that this was, one half desire on the company's part to make money, as they tend, as companies tend to want to do. The other half, I think, was just the fact that this was a whole new executive team, and they didn't quite understand a lot of the commitments that had been made back in 2003. So part of our work and part of the reason why we asked for the meeting was really to make sure that this policy remained meaningful at the company, that this type of market activism that we call it, so this type of lobbying corporate America, essentially, is sort of a new face or a new wave of the environmental movement that I think corporate executives really need to recognize. And so this was kind of our effort to underscore the importance of this issue with the CEO. I think he understands that getting into controversies like this isn't in the best business interest of the company, that really, if you're going into areas that you don't have the social contract to log, and at the end, when folks are considering what paper to buy or considering where to shop for their, wood products or other consumer products, it's going to have an effect on the company. Boise felt that back in 2003, and that's why they adopted the policy. And this was just a little reminder to say that, you know, we're still here. Consumers are still paying attention to environmental issues, and, you know, we're encouraging you to do the right thing.
Were you personally involved in that meeting?
I was, yeah.
And without getting too personal, I'm just curious, what were you witnessing in terms of the CEO's response? I mean, quite honestly, maybe he just really didn't know. You know, I mean, a new guy comes in, a new team comes in, and there's a period of kind of figuring out what the company's all about and how they operate. Did you see sort of a change in his perceptions or his thinking as you talked with him?
Well, that's a good question, you know, and I don't want to read too much into his own intentions or the intentions of his team there. And I, as I said, you know, I think this is probably half misunderstanding, but I think the other half is, you know, we need to pay attention to, which is that clearly, you know, this policy was on the books at Boise Cascade, and clearly in the decision-making of foresters and other decision-makers at the company, this environmental policy and environmental affairs generally are playing second seat to the bottom line. And so what our message was to, you know, clarify for the company that there really is a triple bottom line. You need to be taking care of not only your investors in the bottom line, but you also need to be taking care of the environment, you also need to be taking care of the communities in which you operate. And so that triple bottom line theory is really one that's catching on, I think, in corporate America. Increasingly, we're finding studies that are showing that companies that do pay attention to the environment and set standards and benchmarks and measure themselves on their environmental performance and their community engagement, as well as their bottom line, are really outperforming the competition. So, you know, that business case, I think, is an important one to make with companies, and I think we made it pretty well, and I think it was I think we're being listened to. So whether or not these particular areas ultimately will be logged by Boise Cascade, I don't know, but I'm hopeful. Further on down the road, long term, I think that Boise is going to recognize that, you know, keeping to that triple bottom line commitment is really going to improve their business practices across the board.
Well, certainly commitments made and the responsibility to keep those to the public deals with integrity, and I'm sure that Boise Cascade really doesn't want to be suddenly perceived as a company that doesn't keep those commitments, because these are extremely important things, particularly now as we head into the future where issues of global warming and our environment are becoming the paramount story on the planet right now at every level. And just to take this a step further in relationship to the Katrina issue, because some people are saying, here go the Brazilian rainforest, for example, to supply the wood to rebuild that whole region. What are you hearing about sort of the future of the forests now that Katrina has left its wake of damage and destruction?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the meeting that we did have with the Tom Stevens, CEO of Boise, here at our offices happened, you know, less than a week after the Katrina hurricane had rolled through and the recovery efforts were still trying to kind of pick up steam. We both identified in that meeting the importance of finding ways of helping Katrina that aren't going to sacrifice you know, environmental values. And so there's a real opportunity, I think, to, you know, when the rebuilding does begin, to consider how we can rebuild a community or how we can build a community essentially from the bottom up in an environmentally responsible way. So, you know, there are products out there. There are green, you know, the green building is a concept that's really catching on, I think, in today's marketplace. I'm actually headed to D.C. here in a couple of weeks to go meet with the U.S. Council of Green Builders, which is a network of thousands of builders all over the country that that are grading themselves essentially on the environmental friendliness of the communities and the neighborhoods that they're building. So I think there's a real excellent opportunity to rebuild in a way that's going to be environmentally friendly and ultimately more. Not only more responsible in terms of our global obligations, but also cost-effective, which I think is also very important. You know, energy efficient, using things like passive solar designs in order to cut down on energy costs, and using alternative products that mean that we don't have to go back to the old-growth forests and in order to find the building materials that we need.
What are people discussing in terms of alternatives to wood? What could people think about? Because this is a huge cleanup and rebuilding, huge project. And if we, yeah, I'm just curious, what are people suggesting?
Well, and it goes beyond just alternatives to wood. I mean, certainly alternatives to some of the most, and you know, alternatives to logging in environmentally sensitive areas is really what we're talking about here. And so if you are going to buy wood, green builders would say that you need to do it with certified wood. So the Forest Stewardship Council is an international body that essentially says that this wood was taken from an area that was logged responsibly, as opposed to, you know, in a sensitive rainforest, say, in Indonesia or Malaysia, or as opposed to, you know, an old-growth forest in British Columbia or the Pacific Northwest. So, you know, there are, say, you know, timber plantations that are being planted on former agricultural land in Chile or elsewhere. These are more responsible ways to get our wood. But, you know, it's also important to underscore some of the alternatives as well. So advanced framing technique is simply a way to reduce the amount of wood that one would use when building a home or a commercial space. And there's all sorts of techniques that and products available that can minimize the environmental impact from building.
Now, if people wish to participate and learn more, what would you recommend? There's kind of two ways to go about this. One would be on a local level to discuss or share ideas personally with the Boise Cascade in a responsible way, and the other would be through RAND. What are some of your suggestions on how to accomplish those?
Well, the best thing that you can do is really empower yourself by knowing what the impacts, the environmental impacts and other impacts, frankly, of your buying choices are. So are the products that you're buying being sourced in environmentally responsible ways? And some easy tools are available on the web to help you out with that. So I would encourage folks to visit www.fscus.org. That's the Forest Stewardship Council. And also, if folks are interested in green building, whether they're developers or whether you're just trying to build a new home, the U.S. Green Building Council has some great resources available. So on the web, that's usgbc.org.
Mm-hmm. Well, listen, I certainly appreciate your being on the show and adding your voice to the voice of the earth here. I'd like to perhaps do a follow-up when you come back from the Green Building Conference to hear what people are talking about. I think that could be very useful at this particular time.
Love to come back.
Okay. Brant Olson with the Rainforest Action Network, I want to thank you for being on the Wild Side News.
All right. Thank you very much.
Brant Olson makes the most important point. Please, wherever and however you can, encourage everyone to look for the FSC label on wood products from your local hardware stores as the rebuilding begins. We are forced to make choices now. Let those choices be made with the knowledge that through wise choices, we can help to save this earth. When we return, we go out west to San Francisco where the great redwoods inspired long ago the master of the mystery, John Muir, to walk and write his way right into the middle of our time. From him grew the Sierra Club, which this last week said it's time for us to think anew. We hear that story when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
This grand show is eternal. It is always sunrise somewhere. The dew is never all dried at once. A shower is forever falling. Vapor is ever rising. Eternal sunrise, eternal sunset, eternal dawn and gloaming. On sea and continents and islands, each in its turn as the round earth rolls. The words of John Muir inspired the spirit of the Sierra Club that this past weekend bound its future to the eternal sunrise of change. As the Sierra Club charts its new vision, when we continue, we begin with words by Rachel Carson from The Edge of the Sea. Now I hear the sea sounds about me. The night high tide is rising, swirling, with a confused rush of waters against the rocks below. Once this rocky coast beneath me was a plain of sand, then the sea rose and found a new shoreline. And again, in some shadowy future, the surf will have ground these rocks to sand, will have returned the coast to its earlier state. And so, in my mind's eye, these coastal forms merge and blend in a shifting kaleidoscopic pattern, in which there is no finality, no ultimate and fixed reality, earth becoming fluid as the sea itself.
This last weekend in San Francisco, there was a meeting, a large meeting, an important meeting of the world-famous and very significant Sierra Club. And 4,000 members and more actually went up to San Francisco to take a look at the Sierra Club, take a look at the environment, to discuss their organization and their future, and actually the future of the planet. And there were a lot of amazing people that participated in this particular event. Certainly someone who played a key role in the event is our guest now, Greg Cassini, who is on the board of directors of the Sierra Club. Greg, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much, Sydney.
Is this the first major event like this that has been held for the Sierra Club?
This is the first really large gathering of all our activists and members on a nationwide scale to both come together to share stories with each other, but also to look at where we are as an organization, where we want to go in the future, and how we want to get there. We've never brought this many people together to help us set the direction for the Sierra Club.
It begs the question, was there a specific reason why now, as opposed to some other time?
Well, we've always asked our grassroots leaders to give us input in setting the direction of the Sierra Club. But this time, we decided, in addition to looking at what we should focus on, that we were also going to look at how we should work on it. What capacities do we need to build in order to achieve our goals? This came about as a result of, I'd say, a number of things. First, the study we've been doing with Harvard University to look at how our local chapters and groups can become more effective, but also to take a pause, step back, after the results of the 2004 election, and to say, what are the strengths that we need to build? What are the capacities we need to build? What is the approach that would be most effective in protecting the planet? So it was both of those things.
Of course, the Sierra Club has gone through any number of changes over the last number of years, probably 10 or 12 years, and I suppose that's an effort to try to really identify what's happening in the environmental movement. And of course, there's been quite a bit of discussion about that with such tones as is environmentalism dead in that discussion, and as well just general dissension about how to move forward, what we should be doing, how to organize, et cetera, et cetera. How is that addressed at this particular event?
Sierra Club has always been unique in that we have tens of thousands of people working locally in their communities on behalf of the environment. But we can also then leverage that local strength for a nationwide purpose. And through our self-reflection, you could say, in terms of this National Purpose Local Action Study with Harvard University, we saw that we had a tremendous amount of really untapped potential that we've been very good, I'd say, at individual empowerment, but we really need to start to focus more on collective empowerment. How can we integrate all of those individual group chapter activities so that, you know, as they say, the sum of the parts is greater than the whole? That's really what we came to San Francisco this past weekend to look at, not just where should we put our efforts in terms of the issues that are most important to our leaders, but in terms of everybody working together to achieve a nationwide vision, what are those particular things we can do, strengths we can build, capacity strategies that are going to allow us to really leverage our unique strengths as a nationwide but also local and state organizations.
Why don't you do a comparison between sort of the vision of the pre-conference Sierra Club, and then what has changed to create the vision of the new Sierra Club and its membership and its mission?
Well, we've actually been building up to this for a while. We've been going out to our chapters and groups locally for about 6 months now and asking them locally to bring their leaders together and to ask these very same questions. Where are we committed to work locally? How can our local efforts be leveraged for nationwide impact? What are the specific things we need to do in order to have local efforts combined into a national purpose? That conversation has been going on for a while, but I think that the summit itself has moved us in the direction of having the awareness and the confidence that we really can, when we all come together, leverage those individual strengths. Because this is really the first time in a long time that we've actually gotten together nationwide, thousands of people, and sat down together and really talked with to one another about what I do, what you do, what matters to me, what matters to you, and through a very deliberative process that we put together, asked how does it all fit together. And I think that the big shift here is from focusing on issues to focusing more on a nationwide vision of what we want to achieve. The Sierra Club, I'd say traditionally, has thought in terms of problems that we face, the problems that our communities face, but I think we're moving more in the direction of thinking about solutions and also how we can move from individual action to more collective action, both in terms of our individual units as we organize ourselves working together, but also focusing more on working with others in the community where we live, so that it's not just the Sierra Club, but it's really the community coming together to address the things that we have in common, the commons of all the people, clean water, clean air, those things that, those values that all of us share.
Let's start out by giving some examples of some of those missions, the kind of the issues, the orientation that the Sierra Club had in the past. Just so that people could say, as a starting point, that's kind of how we used to operate, and then try to help us understand how this new approach might accomplish a kind of a wider vision, kind of building on those issue-oriented campaigns.
Well, the Sierra Club has had for a number of years priority conservation campaigns, and we will still have a set of conservation initiatives that we emphasize. But I think that the important distinction here is that as we move forward, we are going to be connecting the work of all of our local units, seeing how, I mean, even using sort of a spider web as a metaphor, seeing that how everything we do, how everyone that is participating in some way in the work of the Sierra Club is connected, but looking at, you know, which of those strings do you pull on to have the maximum impact. Because, in fact, I think we may even be unique in terms of being an environmental organization that will work on any issue that its members want to work on. We empower local activists to work on the issues that they care about. So at the local level, there are just tens of thousands of people all over the country coming together, doing the kinds of work that they individually and collectively believe in. But in the past, we have not made a real concerted effort to think about how we integrate all that work into a larger unified whole that has much more nationwide impact.
That process would have been fascinating, somehow trying to draw out this collective awareness and then define what that is and then as well what to do with it. What did you find out? What were some of the concerns? What were some of the sort of categorical concerns that that people may have been discussing, and then we'll follow up with how did that translate then into the new vision?
Well, their concerns can be put into a number of categories. The particular conservation approaches we want to take, they were very strongly supportive of building a new energy future. The summit and then the pre-summit deliberations locally ranked way at the top. Time and time again, our activists told us that we really want to take a fresh, new, forward-looking approach to the issues that they think are the most important. And they see the issues of global warming and dependence on oil, toxic pollution. Those are, to them, now matters that can't wait, that are urgent, that have risen to the top. They also looked in terms of the capacities that they wanted to build. And there, one result that I found rather interesting is that they placed an emphasis on involving local residents in electoral activity as a top priority.
Hmm.
Despite, you know, the disappointment with the 2004 elections, they said, we need to put more emphasis on state, local, and federal elections. So they are clearly not discouraged. In fact, I think they are more encouraged and energized than we've ever been. I have actually never been to a Sierra Club event where I have seen so much genuine outpouring of appreciation for the efforts of organizing an event. The opportunity to come together to hear really very visionary, very forward-looking speakers on a whole variety of topics, to have the opportunity to see people that they've only, whose names they've only heard, both in terms of speakers and in terms of the activists that they may interact with, you know, via email, but they've never met in person, to actually have them be guided through a process where they can see both a local perspective and a national perspective, where they can talk to a table full of people who come from different backgrounds, different parts of the country, are working on different issues, and to have them sit together and talk about why this is important to me, why this is important to you, is just an experience that they normally don't have, and that I think is just so important to bringing us all together, to realizing that we have a tremendous amount in common, but those differences we have actually can be a strength when they're leveraged properly. We talked a lot after Marshall Kansas presentation on the factors that affect chapter and group effectiveness about the kinds of internal capacities we need to build, the kinds of support our chapters and groups can give to their activists that they can get from the National Sierra Club. It was interesting that our executive director, at the end when he was summing up, Carl Pope, talked about the Sierra Club as a complete human being, and that if you want to engage in a marathon, you need to exercise certain muscles. If you want to be in a rowing competition, you have to exercise a different set of muscles. I really think that was an appropriate analogy, because we are a very complex organism, the Sierra Club, and we can't let any of our muscles atrophy, but we really did come together to decide that over the next 5 years we need to strengthen certain of these muscles. I thought it was the most inclusive, participatory process that the club has engaged in, and I think everybody really was so appreciative of just having the opportunity to have influence over the process. Not all organizations come together to do something like this. In fact, I don't know of any other organization that brings so many people together to make these kinds of bottom-up decisions and to give direction to their national leadership, where they want to go and how they want to get there. I think we really are on the verge of a new way of making decisions in the Sierra Club and governing the Sierra Club. I think that is one of the things that is really exciting for me personally, and also I think for everyone who was there, because they saw how everyone in the Sierra Club can have a voice. And together, we can just change the face of the Sierra Club by coming together. It was, for me, an amazing experience. I've never had so many people just come up to me constantly and thank me for organizing something. It was an amazing experience. I couldn't go from one end of the hall to the other without constantly being stopped and thanked, and total strangers coming up to me and hugging me and saying, what a wonderful job you did. It was really quite gratifying to know that all this hard work we put in over the last year and a half was really appreciated. There's no perfect process that you can come up with, and we wrestled for months as to how to do this, and you can do it many ways. But in the end, everybody recognized that this is a new commitment that the club is making to decision-making in the club, and they saw the opportunity. I think they really seized on the opportunity. Because one of the most interesting things they did was the first question we asked in the direction setting process. We asked them what type of approach they wanted to use moving forward. And we gave them a whole set of very traditional answers they could have chosen from. Incremental, approach, compromise, all or none. But the one that 60% of them chose was a new way of thinking. And I think that they spent the rest of the time really practicing that. And it was, for me, I'd say one of the most amazing experiences I've had as a Sierra Club volunteer, seeing 700 delegates come together in a process where they really were actively engaged in looking at a new way of thinking.
That is fascinating in the sense that they chose that as the mission, and that's what you therefore moved forward with. It sounds as if it was somewhat of a sequential process leading to real outcomes.
Yes, it was exactly that. This was done over 3 days, a four-hour session on Thursday, 2 one-hour open mic sessions on Friday, and another four-hour session on Friday. It was a very choreographed event, you could say, because we had a lot to cover. We needed both to have them be in their groups, talking with people from around the country, getting feedback, learning, listening, before they make decisions, but also we needed everybody to also have the opportunity to speak to the whole group, and we had to balance many different needs in structuring this and get through a whole series of choices in terms of what we want to work on and how we want to work on them. So we spent a year actually preparing this process, and in the end, I am not really surprised that we got where we got, because I know the Sierra Club, and I know that they really are thirsting for a better way. They're thirsting for leadership. And I think if you provide them with the opportunity to participate, they will grab it. That's always been my experience with Sierra Club volunteers at all levels of the club.
You know, Greg, we're going to take a break here and come back on the other side. I'd like to talk about what some of those dreams and missions and processes, concerns, and new thinking. We're talking with Greg Cassini, board member with the Sierra Club. Hold on, we'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
We continue our exploration of the future of the Sierra Club.
Continuing our discussion with Greg Cassini, who is one of the board members with the National Sierra Club, who this last weekend was in San Francisco attending a very historic convention with over 4,000 members who came together to take a look at the Sierra Club and really, really determine where they needed to go now, and how to get there, what they needed to do. And that's what I'd like to focus on now. We've talked about the process, which sounded very, very interesting, a process of self-discovery, identifying the message, and then crafting some new ways to approach things. The Sierra Club wants some new thinking. Well, let's talk about some of the nuts and bolts. What are the main concerns, therefore, of the Sierra Club based on this last week's conference in San Francisco?
One of the main concerns is how do we, in our communities, bring people together to take collective action? How do we reach beyond our membership? How do we seek new allies, build new coalitions? Because we know that most Americans care very deeply about the environment. They want clean water, they want clean air. They're really concerned that we're losing so much of the natural heritage that sustains and enriches our lives. So how do we individually and collectively as an organization bring community members together around our shared values and concerns? And most importantly, how do we act on those concerns? How do we take our concerns to those who represent us? And as a result of that concern, they actually prioritize a number of new initiatives, such as seeking new allies and building coalitions, advocating for solutions. That, I think, is a major concern of the Sierra Club members. They, I think, are tired of being put in the position where they have to constantly fight against bad proposals, or constantly say this level of arsenic in our water versus that level of arsenic in our water. We had some very inspirational speakers, such as Bill McDonough, who has shown us that you don't have to engage in a debate over how many parts per billion of arsenic you want in your water, that you can, as you know, the Creator intended, bring clean water. So another item on our agenda that was prioritized was advocating for solutions, real solutions, and taking that message out to people in our community to educate them that, you know, there is a better way, that we don't have to settle for the kinds of consequences we saw with poor planning from Hurricane Katrina, that we can protect our wetlands, that we can properly store toxic materials, that we can build cities that are livable, and that the commons and the function of government to protect the people is just so primary and so basic that we really need to be speaking out more about it. I'm not settling for a cleanup after the fact, but making sure that we build vibrant, healthy communities from the get-go.
It's pretty well recognized now that Americans all across the spectrum, red, blue, purple, and every other color, they want a clean environment, they want clean air, they want the forests, they want a healthy world. And they know what that means. The trouble is somehow it's been so politicized that it's hard to even know. It just gets so politicized that it's complex. The media seemed to be a main theme in terms of a lot of the messaging going on, that was somehow we have to deal with the media. What can you tell us about that conversation and then how that will play into the future of accomplishing these wider missions for the Sierra Club?
Well, in the conversations we had this weekend, we talked about the need for the media to cover what's really happening out there, to hold local officials, state officials, federal officials accountable for their actions or their lack of action. We had many speakers, Vice President Gore, Robert Kennedy Jr., Arianna Huffington, they all talked about the need to hold officials accountable for their failures. It was really interesting that Mayor Gavin Newsom actually stood up in front of us and said, hold us accountable. As your local municipal officials, we can do a great deal to protect and serve the public. And it's not that hard. He went through a whole litany of things they've done in San Francisco. And he said, you know, it's not that hard to do it. We've done it. You just need to hold us accountable. And while we talk about the role of the media in bringing America's attention to the real problems and the real solutions, I think that your attention is actually focused on rolling up our sleeves, not relying on others, but rolling up our sleeves and getting out there in the communities and talking to people and working with people and creating the kinds of vibrant, healthy communities that we want to have. Because we realize that if we want to do it, the elected officials really are not the ones who are going to provide leadership. We're going to have to provide the leadership. And I think that was very evident in our direction-setting process because they prioritized bringing people together in local communities to take action together. They prioritized building coalitions, seeking allies. They did not focus on, while they talked about media, they did not focus on media. They focused on community action.
I guess my question would be, if without the media, doesn't that make community action more difficult? In other words, if the media were really, if we could figure out the way, and we're all working on that, to really get the media to tell the truth, which is one of the messages as well, to just keep telling the truth, the people are hungry for that, but that would help the overall effort to bring this out to the people, because people aren't getting the truth.
There's no question that that is important. And in fact, Arianna Huffington made the point that we need to constantly go to the media, whether it is through letters to the editor or getting on camera, and keep our message out there. I'm a bit heartened by the response by reporters to Katrina. the humanness that people are now talking about. I hope that that isn't a passing fad. I hope that as a result of the kind of real human coverage we've seen, that they won't backslide when they're covering other issues, and that they will realize that there is a profound impact on the lives of people by the events that they cover, and they won't be afraid to cover them in ways that tell the real story and the underlying problems, and also they can play a tremendous role themselves in advocating for solutions. And I see no reason why someone who is sent to cover a story shouldn't point out when there's a better way to do things. It's just a responsibility of being an American.
I think part of the confusion comes from some sort of mixed up politics that suggests that in order to be a good American, you have to say good things about America, and that if you don't say good things about America, you're not truly a good American. And that that leads to the dilemma that those people who are bringing up problems that deserve to be discussed in the press are perceived as the enemy or un-American. We really have to address that issue, because that's taken us down this path to such levels of confusion and really not a clear vision of what's happening on this planet and to the environment.
Oh, I agree completely with you. I frankly can't understand that attitude, that to say nothing when something is going wrong, in your opinion, is patriotic. I think those who stand up for what they believe in and constantly try to improve the nation are those true patriots. Now, we may disagree on what the best course of action is, but if you don't stand up and speak out, I don't think you're really contributing to the nation.
Speaking to that issue, actually, another huge area of concern right now, and also apparently part of the mission, is to address energy independence, and that came out strongly at this particular event.
Well, actually, before I answer that, let me go back to the question you asked about some of the things that were different as a result of the summit.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you were talking, I realized that one of the big differences I'm seeing, one of the big shifts, is that our members and activists are really not talking so much about the past and the problems. They're really focusing much more on solutions in the future. And I don't think it was the way we structured this convention. The conversations were, by and large, focused on our vision for America and the world moving forward. I spoke with a lot of people there. I listened in on a number of conversations at a number of tables, and I heard people talking about their visions and what they want to achieve. I didn't hear people talking about failures of the past. I didn't hear people really talking about problems. I heard many more conversations about solutions, and I think that was part of the excitement that I felt, that people really believed that we can have a brighter future. And I think that, getting back to your question about the new energy future, that is something that they embrace because they see how they can bring visionary solutions to the American people that can happen today. We really do have the technology to use energy far more efficiently. We have the technology to bring down the cost of renewable energy quickly. We have the technology to raise fuel efficiency standards and not use oil from the Arctic Refuge or the Persian Gulf. We have so many technologies that it really is just a matter of political will. And in fact, one of the very best lines by one of our keynote speakers was that political will is a renewable energy source. That got a great laugh, but, you know, there's a ring of truth to that. I think that this summit made people realize that together, 800,000, 750,000 members working in their communities with people who also want to embrace a better way. Everybody wants clean energy. Everybody wants clean water and clean air. Everybody wants their children to be free of asthma. Nobody wants to see another Hurricane Katrina. And I think that the new energy future, really, to many activists that I've spoken with, was chosen because they know that it's achievable. achievable. They know that they, in their local communities, can work for solutions. I've been working in Colorado on our energy campaign. The people of Colorado passed a citizens' initiative to mandate increased use of renewable sources. They passed a citizens' initiative to build out light rail in the Denver-Boulder metro area. The people, I think, are quite ahead of many of the decision makers in the country. They're really providing the leadership. And I think our leaders at the summit recognize that America is just hungry for someone to provide vision and leadership. And this is one of those issues, energy, that affects a lot of the things that our members care about, whether it's keeping America's natural heritage protected, whether it's keeping the air clean, whether it's keeping the water clean. There are so many different issues that our activists work on that actually are affected by our energy policies that I really am not surprised that there was such strong agreement and commitment to that particular conservation approach.
Now, on a more complex issue, one that is in process, in other words, it's a problem that we're trying to identify and live with, and that would be global warming. How is the response, how is the Sierra Club looking at that enormous issue right now? They've tried so hard to get this more mainstreamed, and it's been a struggle. What is your plan to educate people and get them more aligned with the truth?
I think that the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina is educating people, because when you see people standing knee-deep in toxic water, you can't help but realize the value of clean water. When you see levees break, when you hear about the constant erosion of wetlands that protect the Gulf Coast, you can't help but understand the value of wetlands. So I think that the message is actually getting through. I think people understand that livable cities are just so key to protecting people from natural disasters, that good planning, common sense, understanding the forces of nature, it's just key to building a vibrant, healthy community. I think they understand that if we had listened and planned and prepared, that the tone for Hurricane Katrina would have been far less than it's going to be, both in terms of lives and in terms of dollars and in terms of the extensive environmental damage that's been caused throughout a three-state area.
I know that energy independence and global warming were two issues. Were there any that rose to that level in terms of this particular event?
Well, we looked at broad conservation approaches. We didn't look at specific individual issues. So, for example, under building a new energy future, we talked about energy independence, we talked about global warming, we talked about a number of things, but this was designed to do broad direction setting. Our national leaders and committees are going to be taking all this direction that the delegates have given us, and they'll be coming up with concrete proposals in terms of the short-term and medium-term conservation campaigns that we'll be putting together the rest of this year.
We're talking with Greg Cassini, board member with the Sierra Club, who attended the convention conference in San Francisco this last weekend, an historic event. Let's have a little bit of fun now, because, you know, the Sierra Club has a lot of members, 782,000 members or some number like that. And I know that when I go to a Sierra Club meeting, I see quite a diversity of people. There's a lot of gray hairs and blue heads and then every other color of the rainbow folks in the room. So you got some of the older folks who probably grew up in the old forms of the Sierra Club. How would you get them how could you help them to embrace and adapt to these changes and this new vision that perhaps younger members may take a little more easily?
Actually, I think they have adapted. I don't see a difference among age in terms of an emphasis on and building a new energy future. We actually did specifically recruit younger people to come to this event and to participate in our summit as delegates to this direction setting process. But in talking to Sierra Club activists, young and old, I didn't detect detect any difference in the level of support for building a new energy future.
That's fabulous. How would you therefore encourage, what would be, if you had like three things that people should take away from this conversation that can help them prepare for the new strategies that will be proposed, what might you suggest?
Are you saying three strategies for Sierra Club activists?
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And membership.
Well, I think they should think about their interests, their passion, their skills, and how they can be applied to the broader nationwide work of the Sierra Club. They don't necessarily have to fit into a campaign plan. Everybody, you know, has some skill, some talent that they can bring to the Sierra Club. Find out what you're passionate about, what your skills are, how you can contribute through work on behalf of the Sierra Club to improving the environment where you live. I'd also say, think about the ways in which your community can help to build a healthier, more vibrant future for itself. The Sierra Club is going to be moving to reach out to communities all across America to help them build a better future. What is the future that your community wants? How could the Sierra Club help support that better future? I would say that would be my second suggestion. Think about the needs of your community. Every community has a need for a brighter energy future. Every community has a need to prevent its citizens from pollution and toxics. And the third thing I would say, think about the power when there are hundreds of thousands of activists all across the country working toward a shared vision. Everybody wants to be part of something that's bigger than yourself. So to all those folks out there, I would say, come and be a part of something that together we can have much more impact on than if we just acted as 100,000 individuals.
Very good. In the future here, I hope to be able to have the actual audio from the some of the addresses from Al Gore and Robert Kennedy Jr., for example, who I understand both of them literally brought people to tears and got people on their feet cheering.
Oh, they did.
Mm-hmm.
They were amazing.
Mm-hmm.
People have not even stopped talking about their speeches. Mm-hmm. They were so moving. I don't think I've ever seen Al Gore give a better speech.
He's getting better.
He is, and Kennedy was in fine form.
Mm-hmm.
He had every fact and figure at his fingertips, and he just went on and on and on. I don't think he even looked at his notes. It was amazing. And he was so moving, so inspirational. People were on their feet I don't know how many times.
It's fabulous. Well, hopefully I'll be able to get that and post that on the website here in the future here so that people can, I do believe there's something in the voice that is critical to really inspiring people to action. And that's why I like to refer to this as the voice of the earth, or bring the voices alive. Greg Cassini with the Sierra Club. Tell people who are either members now or who may have an interest in becoming a member and finding out more about the Sierra Club, what's the best way for them to do that?
I would recommend you go to our website, sierraclub.org, and look up your local chapter or group. We have organized activists in every state and practically every community in America. No matter where you live, there's probably an active group of Sierra Club members working in your community. So I suggest go to sierraclub.org, see what we're doing, then call up the leaders that you see and talk to them about your community, your interests, what they're doing, and come out, see what we're doing, meet us, talk to us, and be a part of it.
I think people will be excited about some of the new vision, some of the new positive thinking that is going to come out of the Sierra Club. This was a historic event, and Greg Cassini, I want to thank you so much for giving us this overview and insight into the success of this last week's events in San Francisco at the Sierra Club Conference. Thanks for joining us on the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney. I appreciate the opportunity.
One final paragraph of advice is how Edward Abbey began the following advice to the activists. Do not burn yourselves out. Be as I am, a reluctant enthusiast, a part-time crusader, a half-hearted antic. Save the other half of yourselves and your lives for pleasure and adventure. It is not enough to fight for the land. It is even more important to enjoy it while you can, while it's still here. So get out there and hunt and fish and mess around with your friends, ramble out yonder and explore the forests, encounter the Grizz, climb the mountain, bag the peaks, run the rivers, breathe deep of that yet sweet and lucid air, sit quietly for a while, and contemplate the precious stillness, that lovely, mysterious, and awesome space. Enjoy yourselves. Keep your brain in your head, and your head firmly attached to the body active and alive, and I promise you this much. I promise you one sweet victory over our enemies, over those desk-bound people with their hearts in a safe deposit box and their eyes hypnotized by desk calculators. I promise you this. You will outlive the bastards. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives, when once again your voice of the earth will ring out here on the Wild Side News.